Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Humans are social animals. We need to work together, and most of us love to get together with friends and family. But today's guest believes that convention and routine have made many of our gatherings stale and meaningless. But don't worry, she has some very clear ideas about how to fix those problems. Priya Parker is the founder of Thrive Labs. She's also the author of The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. And she is with me on the phone right now. Hello, Priya.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I wonder, when did this become important to you? Was there a moment in your life when you thought, you know what, we could be gathering better?
I would go to conference after conference and see speakers on the stage sometimes giving great talks and audiences kind of staring like robots at the stage and thinking, there's so much more we could do here. There's so many more interesting people in the room. How do we connect to each other? Or dinner parties where the food is gorgeous and the flowers, you know, are taller than your head. And everything was focused on the kind of the things and the ambiance and the environment of the gathering, but then people weren't connecting. And I basically would go to gathering after gathering and leave often feeling kind of depressed or slightly empty and thought there must be a better way.
There are a lot of people who have advice about optimizing your business environment, making your convention great, making your business meetings work, et cetera. There are a lot of people that focus on the social side, how to entertain and be a great host. But you have brought both of those together, the business meetings and the social meetings. Why?
Because I think that we are meeting all of the time for different purposes, but the dynamics of a group are consistent regardless of the context. So I come to this book, The Art of Gathering, as a conflict resolution facilitator. My training is in group conflict resolution based on when a group is having some kind of problem, first with race relations in the United States, bringing together college students after some kind of racial incident to come together and talk over time sustainably about how do you actually change race relations on college campuses. And in part because I started my work in such an extreme context, I began to see that the same dynamics of conversation or people willing to actually say what they think versus, swallowing their actual beliefs were the same dynamics that I saw in boardrooms and around dinner parties. People are people, and we each have different parts within us. I have a businesswoman. I am a mother. I am a daughter. I am a conflict resolution facilitator. I am a bad cook. And depending on the gathering, I might decide which part of myself to show. But we are all doing that all of the time. And so I wanted to write a book about gatherings, not about categories.
Well, and you start the book off with something that, to me, all of a sudden I realized, oh, no, I'm doing everything wrong. And I'm sure a lot of people who open the book feel the very same way, because the very first thing you tell us is that you need to have a purpose. You need to decide what the purpose is for this gathering. So because we meet daily at 2 is not the purpose that you're looking for?
Exactly. We tend to meet, particularly in our organizations, in our schools, in our factories, in our public squares, out of habit. Perhaps when you first started that staff meeting, there was a need to meet. A company grew big enough that somebody realized that you needed to coordinate. But over time, people start meeting because we always meet on Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock. And when all of a sudden you continue to meet because you met before, it starts to get quite boring. And so the first question to ask in every type of your gathering, the more habitual, the more important it is to ask it, is why are we meeting? I've had people come up to me actually since they've read the book and say, you know, I tried out asking at my staff meeting, regular staff meeting, so why are we meeting today? And it was actually a very controversial question. And it began a conversation to say, when do we need to meet? Why do we need to meet? And if we don't need to meet, let's cancel the meeting.
With a meeting at work, a staff meeting at work, does it need to be the person in charge who finds the meaning and gives it purpose?
Such a great question. I wrote this book and I named it The Art of Gathering and not The Art of Hosting. And I called it The Art of Gathering because I think guests have enormous power. And most of us are guests more often than we are hosts. And so, and guests can absolutely, one, change the dynamic of a room, but two, kind of stage a kind coup to help a group find its focus. So if you're sitting in a staff meeting or you're a teacher and you're sitting with other fellow teachers or the head of school and people are going around in circles, to simply ask, hey, can we just step back a minute? I'm confused. So what are we trying to get out of this? Or what is the purpose of today? Or why are we meeting? In a social context, often friends get together. I was at a conference a couple of years ago, and there was a free evening the night before that the conference didn't coordinate. And so a number of guests said, hey, let's go out for dinner. So we went out for dinner. I was at this table, and everybody was making small chat with each other to the people, you know, to the left and right of them. And all of a sudden, one guest, she didn't know other people necessarily, whispered over to another guest and basically said, hey, how do we have a meaningful conversation here? What if we ask everybody a question? And so she dinged her glass to get everyone's attention and said, hey, like, we're all here. We have a common purpose. If we're all interested in this conference, would you guys be up for sharing more meaningful conversation? And she asked everybody the question. It was something like, what is your biggest fear right now in your life? And she made up the question, but and she went first, and she was 50 years old, and she said, I'm turning 50, and it's the first time I've ever truly thought about death. And it completely transformed the room, and she did that as a guest.
I think a lot of us will easily accept the idea that we need to really have a purpose in our business gatherings or gatherings with other professionals. But, you know, is the purpose of, hey, it's the 4th of July and we like you, is that enough of a purpose? Do we really need to have something beyond that when we get together socially?
It's the 4th of July, to me, is a purpose, but it's a vague purpose. And so one of the things that allows a gathering to take off, you know, when I wrote this book, I stepped back and interviewed 100 gatherers around the world who don't necessarily think of themselves as gatherers. So in an extreme context, a rabbi, a dominatrix, a photographer who has 7 minutes with a head of state to get the right picture and figure out how to get the head of state to kind of take his or her mask off to get the shot. And I asked each of them, how do you create a transformative gathering? Like, why do sometimes things work and sometimes they don't? And one of the things they said was the more specific a gathering can be, the more people can kind of know how to show up. And so I'll give you an example of a 4th of July. 4th of July, we kind of go through the same routines over and over again. To have a purpose of the 4th of July, so what's the purpose? Well, some people would say it's to celebrate the country, or it's to mark independence, or it's to remember the birth of the country. And who should I invite? Yes, the people that I like. But how can you, besides just having hot dogs and hamburgers and having the form of the 4th of July, how do you bring the meaning of the 4th of July into conversation in a way that helps people remember that 4th of July, you know, from all of the other 4th of Julys they've ever attended? Asking the question, how do you think we're doing as a country? What are the founding beliefs that we, you know, the Declaration of Independence, are we living up to them? Are we not? And how do we as citizens, you know, change something? So specificity transforms gatherings.
Do you think that that kind of specificity is necessary in a social gathering? I mean, we do like these informal get-togethers. Are we missing something if we just enjoy being together?
Yeah, it depends on what your purpose is. So I think, you know, if you want to grab a drink with friends or you want to have a pizza night and, you know, play games, I think that's fantastic. A purpose doesn't have to be serious. I think your purpose can be, I'm exhausted. I'm most happy when I'm with these 6 friends. I need to spend time with them. Like, let's hang out. So it doesn't have to be structured necessarily in a specific way. I'll give you another example. I was recently speaking with a writer, fabulous writer named Jancy Dunn, and she wanted to host a dinner party, and she had noticed that she'd been going to dinner parties where there wasn't a specific purpose, and she left kind of feeling like, well, I don't really know why that didn't take off. So I was talking to her on the phone, and I said, well, why do you want to have a dinner party? And she said, well, you know, just have a dinner party. And I said, well, okay, let's ask this a different way. What is a need right now in your life that other people might be able to help you with? And she said, well, I'm kind of a worn-out mom. I have two young kids. I was at a friend's house the other day, and she made me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. She cut it into triangles. She cut off the crusts. She gave it to me, and I almost burst into tears because I felt so taken care of. And she said, what if I did a dinner party for the other worn-out moms in my life, and we just sort of have a night where we take care of ourselves? Great. Give it a name. She said, okay, why don't I call it the Worn-Out Moms Hootenanny? Okay, give it a rule. Okay, if we talk about our kids, we have to take a shot. And I said, okay, put it in an email, send it out. Paperless post, Evite? No, just simple. Put it in an email and tell the peanut butter and jelly story. So she did. She gave it a name. She made the rule. And all six friends RSVP'd yes within an hour. And she hosted this worn-out mom's hootenanny. And it was joyful. And they did takeout, so no one was cooking. It was embodied the principles of being worn out. But it was a way for her friends to connect in a way that, again, was specific but still full of joy and was meaningful because it matched a need in their life right now.
Well, and I'm struck by the amount of effort that she needed to put into thinking of the idea was probably far less than she would have put into trying to host a more traditional dinner party.
Yes. And to me, that's the core message of the book, is that this is actually not more work. It's less work. It's spending more time thinking intentionally about why do I want to get people together and who do I want to get people together, and spending less time on, you know, the crudités.
We are going to have to take a short break here in a moment, but we will talk much more about gathering, how to have great parties, great social gatherings, also how to make a business meeting more meaningful, more productive. Conventions, funerals, weddings, all kinds of gatherings. We're going to talk more in a moment. With me is Priya Parker. She is the founder of Thrive Labs. She's also the author of The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. And you are welcome to join our conversation. Maybe you need a little bit of advice. You have a disastrous gathering story to share, or tell us about the best, most meaningful gathering you've been a part of. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about creating meaning, getting more meaning out of all of our different kinds of gatherings, whether they're social gatherings or business gatherings, professional gatherings. With me is Priya Parker. She is the founder of Thrive Labs and the author of The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. And you are welcome to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Priya, before the break, we were talking a lot about coming up with a purpose for a gathering, a purpose being key to having a successful gathering. Let's talk about the guest list, who to include in a gathering, because that's also an incredibly important element. And you make the point in a number of different ways that you believe that deciding who not to include may be just as important as deciding who to include.
That is the line where your purpose starts to have meaning. Who do you not include based on your purpose? I had a friend a few months ago who was invited to his grandmother's 80th birthday party by his grandmother. And the invitation was peculiar because she sent an invitation. She lives in Germany. Her grandchildren are spread around the world. And she issued an invitation to all of her grandchildren to join her on her birthday without their partners or their children. Now, this caused some controversy within the family. Some of the spouses felt, you know, neglected. Some of the grandchildren were thinking this is very strange. But she said, that is my wish on my 80th, and in a way, take it or leave it, Granny. And the cousins, most of them went. I was very intrigued by this invitation, as you can imagine. And when my friend came back, I said, how was it? And he said, you know, it was kind of amazing. It was the first time in my adult life, he's in his mid-30s, that I reconnected and spent time, endless time, days with my cousins since we were children. And we realized that we actually hadn't figured out our adult relationship with each other. It was a gift. But Granny had to kind of fight and be willing to take some heat.
Or to be old enough not to care, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And to me, it was this beautiful, simple example where she understood what her purpose was this year, right? It wasn't every year. The next year, you know, other people can be invited. But for this year, for this moment, for this gathering, what is my purpose? And based on that, your purpose isn't sharp enough until you start realizing who shouldn't be there, and you start to get a little nervous. If you're not yet nervous, your purpose is not specific enough.
The idea of excluding someone who may know about the gathering or may want to be there, I mean, thinking about those significant others or those great-grandchildren, you know, that just gives me an anxiety attack.
Me too.
That's horrible. So, that's so difficult.
Yeah. Yes, and I think, you know, part of our gathering wisdom has always been, at least I grew up, and by the way, I have an Iowa connection. My father was born and raised in Waterloo, Iowa, and I was always taught the more the merrier. You know, you can always squeeze one more person in. And part of this, I believe, is we've misunderstood what that meant. In most cases for gatherings, it's the more the scarier when you have a specific purpose, particularly in companies and businesses. When you don't know, we over-include because we're afraid of conflict. And yet when we over-include, we're not protecting our guests that kind of should be there. So whether it's, again, a simple example, a couple from my own life, I was getting married. My father, who's from Iowa, and my stepmother, who's from Florida, were going to meet for one of the first times, my in-laws. And my aunt, my step-aunt, happened to be visiting my parents. They were going to meet for tea. And my husband and I were we frankly didn't want my aunt there, not because we don't love my step-aunt, but because that wasn't the purpose of the meeting. And because at some level, once a person's in the room, if you're a generous host, you're going to spend more attention on the person furthest from the purpose, you know, furthest outside to make them feel included. And it distracts from the purpose of a very important meeting in our eyes. And so part of dealing with the anxiety you talk about so well is to defend the reason that you're meeting based on the purpose. So in a work context, when you start meeting purposefully and people know that not everybody's invited to all of your meetings, when they do get invited, they know that it's actually a form of honor. They know that you actually want them to be there.
This strikes me that you have to be really open in your communication and good at communicating to be able to do that without damaging relationships?
I would put it slightly differently. I think to be explicit about your purpose, more than the communication, because we all, when you know what to say, most of, you know, you can figure out a way to say it. So the first thing I'd say is pick up a phone and tell people if you're worried about if someone approaches you or says, why wasn't I invited? And it's an important relationship to you, pick up the phone and have a quick chat and just explain the context. Most people, when they understand the context and the purpose, even if they feel slightly wounded, they understand. Don't do it in a text or an email. But the second thing is, I think most people are better at communication and less clear on getting on the purpose of the gathering. So when we are muddled, our communication gets muddled. But when we are clear and get excited about a purpose of a business meeting or of an offsite, all of a sudden the words are much simpler because you've gotten clear in your head about who is this for, who is this not for, and why are we doing this.
Let's talk about the size of a gathering, because you share some really fascinating information about group dynamics and how the number of people in a gathering really can affect so many different parts of the meaning and the pleasure and the purpose of the gathering. And so let's kind of step it up. You start with the number 6. Why is that an important number?
6 is a wonderful number for group intimacy. It's big enough that you kind of have a life of a conversation or life of 6 people, you know, 3, 4, 5. It can be harder to take off. When you see this, like in churches, groups of 6 are often a number that people have to make in a mega church to make the church feel smaller. You know, prayer groups are often 6. The Young Presidents Organization, YPO, which is an organization that helps bring together presidents of companies, you know, all over the world, and they do these fellowship groups where they have kind of board of directors, and they're always groups of 6. Groups of 8 to 12 are wonderful for group conversation. A little less intimate, but much more diversity of perspective. So one of the dangers of a group for 6 is that it can't carry dead weight. You know, if 2 people aren't really into it, or if one person's kind of throwing stones at it, it's difficult to kind of get the life of the group up. In conflict resolution and in group dynamics, we almost always have 8 to 12 in a circle. And with that, when we are organizing conferences, we often divide the number of people in a room by 12, and then put a facilitator in each of those circles.
All right, and 12 is kind of a magic number in some ways. Why do you think 12 is so important?
12, in a way, 12 is the double of 6. It's a number that tends to allow everybody, if well facilitated or well hosted, to talk. But also, particularly for introverts or people who are more interested in conversation but don't have to kind of like carry all of the weight, you are also allowed to kind of sit and witness a community. 12 is the size of a community. So whether you think of, you know, the Last Supper or different kind of iconic and archetypical moments in gatherings, 12 tends to be a number where you can still sit around a table but really have a sense of community.
And you have found, and many people have reported that, for example, in a business environment with a startup, when the number of people who are involved in the decision-making, who are included in meetings, exceeds that number of 12, sometimes some real problems crop up.
Yes. We often call it the table moment, which is when you are small enough as a company or as an organization, an NGO, and you have 6 to 8 people, you can really just say, hey, let's grab a chair and talk, you know, talk about our plans. All of a sudden, when you have 14 or 18 or 20 people, the same habit exists. So the CEO or a vice president or a, you know, a head principal will say, hey, let's grab a few chairs. 6 people tend to then grab a few chairs, but or 12 people. And the other 8 people think, why wasn't I invited? And the host is still mimicking the same dynamics as if they were the same size. But actually, when people can't sit at the table, that's actually when the complicated system, that's usually when an organization needs to actually embed process and structure into how they meet and why it matters. Because people, to our earlier conversation, get hurt. Even though when people gather, it's unintentional. There wasn't enough people in the room, or they didn't think that they needed to be part of the conversation. So often in when companies grow, people are brought in to start setting up, you know, an invoice processing system when all of a sudden the numbers start getting bigger, because you can't just do things informally anymore because people get hurt.
All right, let's talk about a bigger number, the number 30, which is another one that you sort of single out as being an exciting number.
30, you start getting that buzzy energy of a group. 30 is great for parties as opposed to a dinner party. So, you know, it's kind of people are all standing around, or a networking night. Again, if you wanted to pause and give a toast or have people share something with each other, it's still big enough. It's still small enough that people feel a sense of intimacy. There may be strangers in the room, but they're potentially knowable. It's much harder to have intimate conversation. It's much easier to group, again, in a conference, to group those people into 6 groups of 5, you know, for 20 minutes to share kind of who they are or what they're working on. It's harder to do it. It can be done well if it's a strong facilitator, but 30 in a room to have one single conversation, people will likely be, you know, there'll be some dominant voices and some people who stay quiet.
Now, let's take a big jump up to 150 people, which is a point, it's kind of a tipping point for the group dynamic or for group unity, right?
Yeah, so 150 or about there is in anthropological circles a size that they call Dunbar's number, the size where all of a sudden it's sort of the average size of a tribe. It's the average at some point. There's been different numbers thrown around, but it's also the average number that a lot of people have on Facebook in terms of friends. It's sort of the number you can keep track of in your life. When my husband and I got married, we had a Belgian wedding host, the woman who hosted the our wedding, and she said between 120 and 150 were the size of the weddings over and over and over again. That just felt beautifully intimate, but also buzzy. And it's the number that in a room you can still kind of make eye contact with. So if 30 you can kind of still talk to, 120 you can still make eye contact with, if well designed and people are moving around. Which again, simply making eye contact with people increases the warmth and connection in a room. When you start feeling connected to people, you're much more willing to take a risk, which, by the way, is another element of transformative gatherings, than you would if you kind of feel like this is a group of strangers. I have no idea who this is, so I'm going to stay in my own corner with the two people I came with.
We are talking about gathering. Priya Parker is my guest. Her book is The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions, your stories about the most meaningful gatherings you've been a part of. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Joanne is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Joanne.
Hello.
And you have a story to share. Tell us about it.
Well, my sister has a birthday for me every year, and we ask the guests to bring a poem they like to share. And we have a little social time, then we have everybody reads their poem, then we have another social time, and it goes very well. It's very nice, and you hear good poetry. So.
And it sounds like it means a lot to you.
Yes, it does.
Well, Joanne, thank you so much for sharing that. Priya, what do you think about that?
I love that. And one of the things that Joanne and her sister are doing is that they are beginning the gathering before it's begun, which is they are asking their guests not to bring a bottle of wine or not to bring some food or flowers, but to think about a poem that they want to bring to the gathering. And so one of the principles that you're doing so well is that you're basically hosting them from the moment of the invitation, the moment they discover that they're going to this birthday party. And so they're starting to think about this gathering. They, you know, what's a poem I like? What's a poem I'm willing to share with a group? What's a poem I want to think about the birthday girl? It's brilliant, and it's simple. So, people often say what you said, Charity, at the beginning of our conversation today, which is, oh my gosh, I'm doing everything wrong. This actually simplifies, like, read the book. It simplifies how we gather because you have a sandwich structure. You chat, then you read the poem, and then you chat. It's beautiful. It's simple, and it gives people a sense of focus. So they don't have to rely on themselves.
With each other, because if you hear
exactly.
Somebody else read a poem that moves you, then suddenly
exactly.
You have something to talk to them about, which is beyond, oh, how has your summer been?
Exactly. And it's an indirect way of if you're really listening, what is that person going through in their life that they chose that poem?
We are talking about the art of gathering, and I want to talk about settings. That's something that I think that we instinctively know is important with some kinds of gatherings. You know, when people decide to get married, the setting is incredibly important to them.
Mm-hmm.
But with so many other kinds of gatherings, setting is an afterthought or a default. And you make the point that it can be really, really powerful. How?
One of the people I interviewed in this book is a facilitator named Patrick Frick, and he talks about when he facilitates any type of gathering, he first thinks about what the room is. One of the things he says that I love is that rooms come with scripts. So when you walk into a boardroom, people are behaving, are more likely to behave formally, to kind of use their kind of analytical side. When you walk into a dance club, you're more likely to, you know, perhaps physically move your body in a slightly different way, make different types of jokes. And when you don't realize that a room comes with a script, your room is working for you or against you no matter what, even if it's a white box of a room. The idea is to think about what is your purpose and what is a context or setting that would help bring this about. So so one of the things that is a deadening for gatherings is when people start following scripts and go on autopilot. So for example, if you're holding a board meeting, and you need people to behave differently and get out of their roles, what would it look like to host a board meeting in a cemetery and ask the same question? What do we want our legacy to be?
You also write that the setting can influence a gathering in ways that you might not expect. I mean, you're talking about choosing a setting that sparks conversation or helps people engage in the purpose of the meeting. But you also write about meetings that have been destroyed.
Yes.
By a bad gathering place. And we're just about to come up on another break, but one of those big things is the amount of space available. So we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. My guest today is Priya Parker. She is the founder of Thrive Labs. She's the author of The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. And you are welcome to join our conversation. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Maybe you've seen some of these ideas in action. We'd love to hear your stories. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Priya Parker. She is the founder of Thrive Labs, and she is the author of The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. And you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've been talking about why setting is so important, and you made the point about how choosing a good setting or even a provocative setting can really help you fulfill the purpose of a meeting. I do want to talk about how large a setting, how large a gathering space should be. But before that, I want you to tell me about the Chateau Principle, because I think it's such a beautiful illustration of how a setting can change a purpose and change a conversation.
So this was a time where two massive global communication companies were thinking of merging, Lucent and Alcatel. And my character was the key advisor to one of the companies, Chris Varelas. He was a merger and acquisitions investment banker, and he was part of all of these negotiations. And he told me the story where at the final meeting, so whenever two companies of that size merge, you know, it's often 100 meetings over the course of a year. And once they figured out all of the terms, the final meeting is one where basically both sides meet, all of the lawyers, all of the accountants, all of the, you know, often all of the people on the board, the CEOs, and they basically do rounds and rounds of due diligence to kind of sign the deal. And they usually do this in a nondescript hotel. In this case, it was going to be in New Jersey. And at the last minute, one of the directors on the French side, so American company and a French company, got sick and asked if they could actually host it in France. And so they did, without thinking about it. And they did it in a chateau. So they literally moved from a nondescript airport hotel to a chateau that the company had some relationship with. And over the course of 3 days, the way Chris Varelas describes it is he saw basically the French company, in his words, become more and more French, and became more and more kind of arrogant, saying things like, "Well, when we take over, and when we run this show," and basically what happened was, as they sat in a place of grandeur that also was on their territory, the underlying premise of the deal was the idea that both of these companies were equal, and that Lucent was going into it with that understanding. But basically, as they began to change their behavior, and Chris says he's 100% sure it was because of the room, because everything else lined up, and actually the deal went through, I think, about 3 years later. Henry Schatt, the CEO, basically stormed out at the last minute because of the way the French were behaving. And the deal fell apart. And it fell apart, you know, the Wall Street Journal had already issued its stock price, which you know, at that point, the deal's basically done. And to this day, Chris says that the reason why he thinks the deal fell apart was because of the place they decided to host it and the way that it affected one side's behavior.
Let's talk about space, because you actually give us a little bit of math that we can do in the book to figure out how large a venue we should have given the kind of party that we want to have. And you don't have to give us all the numbers, but tell me a little bit about how the math works.
Yes. So The idea is that the density of a room matters. One of the reasons why parties always end up in the kitchen, and I didn't realize this, I learned this from an event planner named Billy Mack, is because people naturally seek out denser and denser places to keep the energy alive. And so if you're wanting there's a table in my book, which you can look at by Billy Mack, that says, you know, if you want a density to have a formal kind of affair versus if you want intimate versus if you want what he calls hot, how many people should be in a room given the size. And you, again, a lot of the stuff you don't have, it's not complicated. I was facilitating a gathering in California a couple of years ago, and it was a public forum to get citizen input about the future of the use of the Presidio, which is sort of a big location there. And before the talk, we invited a number of citizens to come together and just have drinks. But the Presidio is humongous. And so about 100 people walked in, and a very quick-thinking architect who was in the room realized that that this place, even though there's 100 people, would feel very flat if we just let people roam around the room. So she took the flip charts that we'd been using all day in the workshop and just lined them up, creating
created
a small
walls.
Circle.
Right.
Yeah, and it saved the evening. So she created density, spontaneously. Another form of density is when you're sitting at a table in a restaurant or at your home, to always put people at both ends of the table. People tend to do this at their home naturally, but often in restaurants when they seat you, you can sit on three chairs on one side, three chairs on the other side, almost like a tennis match. But it ends up leaking, the kind of having two open ends of the table doesn't. And so when you so remove one of the tables and actually have seat both extra two people on either side of the table, so you become a closed table. So the perimeter of the gathering also matters, that you feel like it's a closed, contained space.
Interesting. Well, let's get to another principle that you have, which kind of goes against the fashion of today. Your advice is to not be a chill host. And I think a lot of us are worried about being overly controlling or being too uptight. The idea of being a chill host sounds pretty appealing, but you think that can kill a gathering as well.
When I say chill, I don't mean relaxed. When I say chill, it's this idea that has come up over the last, 5 to 10 years, particularly among the millennial classes, sort of like, everything's chill. Like, it's chill. We don't have to, chill out, man. Like, why are you so uptight? And I think basically chill is a desire to not look like you care. And gathering is a form of love. And it's also a form of power. You're bringing people together. You're implicitly saying, hey, this is why I want people to come together. At some level, if they say yes. I believe every gathering is a social contract. There's an invitation that people can say yes or no to. If they say yes to, you need to help understand what are they saying yes to. And rather than being chill, which by that means, if someone's talking in a dinner and no one else is talking, as a host, you need to figure out how to get that person to, talk less and everyone else to talk more. If someone's getting cornered in a corner of the kitchen and clearly doesn't want to be part of the conversation, you need to protect your guests. And so in this chapter, Don't Be a Chill Host, I say you need to do three things. You need to protect your guests, you need to connect them to each other, and you need to equalize them. My favorite example of this is actually a private company called the Alamo Draft House. It's based in Austin, Texas, but has now spread across the country. And they, like Lowe's or AMC, have a rule where you can't text or talk on the phone during the movie. But unlike Lowe's or AMC, they enforce it. They protect their guests. And the way they enforce it is they allow anybody in the room, any viewer, to put up a card that they could also be ordering drinks or food in, so people don't know that you're actually telling on them, if you see someone texting. And the staff will come over and give that person a warning. And if they do it again, they'll kick them out. And they actually kick them out. And people have gotten very upset by being kicked out, being a paid moviegoer. And what the CEO of the Alamo Drafthouse says is, we have a purpose, and our purpose is to bring back the magic of the movies. And if we don't, and what we're doing by kicking people out without following the rules is we're protecting our purpose.
And you're protecting the other guests from having
yes.
to get involved with each other.
Exactly. And they're not, exactly. They're not putting the weight on the guests because, you know, how many times have you been in a movie theater when someone's talking loudly or whispering? Do you give them a bad look? Do you say something? Do you escalate it? And most movie theaters don't get involved unless they're literally sending in security. So part of what the Alamo Drafthouse is, I call it generous authority. They're practicing the authority, but they're doing it with the spirit of generosity to protect the purpose and to protect their guests. And if you want to text in a movie theater, go somewhere else.
You know, you have another piece of advice that I think is brilliant, but it also is counter to what a lot of us do when we have a gathering. I mean, when we invite people over, we kind of are showing off a little, but you want us to let down our guard. As a host, we need to be vulnerable and real, or our guests won't be vulnerable and real, right?
Yes. One of the people who is most articulate about the power of connection through vulnerability right now is Brené Brown. The majority of her work, though, is focusing on one-to-one vulnerability, and she has, you know, beautiful books and studies that show that people tend to connect when we are vulnerable and kind of show our sides to each other. My addition to this is, what does this actually look like in groups? And as a host, if you're hosting and you're hoping that people will share more of themselves, you need to share more of yourself. So one of the examples I give in a book is a dinner party format called 15 Toasts. What you do is you invite people to come. You choose a theme that's kind of relevant to the purpose of your gathering. So it could be motherhood, it could be fatherhood, it could be borders, it could be immigration, it could be America, it could be anything that's on your mind that's related to this group. Again, going back to your purpose. And the rules are as follow, and you explain this at the beginning of the night. Invite people to, at some point in the night, ding their glass, stand up, kind of old school style, and give a toast based on the theme. But the toast is not an opinion. It's a story or an experience that's relevant to the theme from your life. And the only other rule is the last person has to sing their toast. It moves the night along, I guarantee you. And I've done this, you know, 20 or 30 times all over the world in different contexts. And one of the things I've realized, even if I'm doing it with a company where I'm coming in as a professional, is that for this to work, I need to let my guard down. I need to give a toast that puts some skin in the game. I need to show that I'm willing to go where I want my people to go. And if you're not willing to kind of show the chinks in the armor, then no one else is going to be.
I want to read an email that kind of echoes what you were saying earlier when we were talking about being very careful about who you invite to a gathering. This is from Jane in Washington. She said, "My family of origin, two parents and five children, has tried to gather once a year for the past few years. My parents are now in their 80s, and we siblings are each in our 50s, so we really appreciate the reality that we live a limited amount of time. We do not leave anyone out, but rather extend the invitation just to the seven of us, looking at it from the positive side. This enriches and deepens our relationships with each other, which then benefits those family members who we love dearly who are not included in these gatherings. It's always a beautiful time together." So that just echoes what you were saying earlier about your intentionality.
Completely. It's understanding, as she said, that time is limited. And when you are asking people to come together, you're asking for the most precious resource, which is time. And the second thing you're asking for is attention, their attention. And so when you start gathering, again, with purpose, people are also willing to show up in ways that they may not otherwise. This family understands that they won't be seven forever, you know. And so, therefore, when they're actually there, my guess is because they understand that it's such a limited, precious time, they're much more radically present. They're probably, hopefully, not on their phones the entire time. They're not thinking about, you know, they're not working on the side. They're really there. And the huge part of the, you know, most people think that my advice is, like, no matter what, gather more. I actually think in a lot of contexts we should be gathering less. We should be gathering more thoughtfully when we really have a purpose to gather. But if you're not really sure why you're coming together, then wait until you truly have a need, because people will show up differently when they feel that you're coming together for a reason, and that reason can only be fulfilled if they are also there.
We have this comment from Connie, who called in from the road. She says, for my sister's 60th birthday, all she wanted was for her four siblings to get together. They went to a cabin and each had to travel about 5 hours. No spouses or kids, which was weird but good. And Connie said that she wishes that they would have had more time. So she's curious if you have suggestions for length of a gathering, which I know you have a lot of thoughts about. And in this case, Connie felt that one was too short. But how do you decide how long a gathering should be?
That's such a great question. It depends on, I would say this, what is the amount of time whereby people can be radically present? So for some, and by the way, that is a very relative question. So, you know, one of the most powerfully transformative gatherings in the meditation world is a process called Vipassana. And the Vipassana kind of training is a 10-day experience in silence, no phones. And silence means no speaking, but it also means no data input, no email, no phones. And so people, but if you want to do it, you know, again, that's the social contract. You have to prepare yourself to be ready to go into silence for 10 days. And so similarly, as you think about what's the right time to engage the people who figure out your purpose and then engage your siblings to ask them. Maybe this one sibling felt like it was too short, but her two brothers felt like it was just enough time, and after that, you know, their family was going to explode waiting for them back home. And so part of this is when you start to collectively figure out your purpose and collectively figure out what can I give, the math starts to work out. One of the experiments my husband and I have tried in New York City where we live is a gathering called I Am Here Days. We started this right after we were married when we moved to the city, and we gathered 6 to 8 friends, and the rules were as follow. You may start noticing I'm a fan of rules, even if they're playful rules. Show up on time, stay the whole time, be game for anything, and turn off your phone. And people would come at 10 a.m., and we'd stay all the way till sometimes 10 p.m., so 12 hours, and explore a neighborhood on foot. In New York, it's easier because there's, you know, dozens and dozens of neighborhoods. But basically what we started realizing was when a group of adults, sometimes we didn't know each other, they're friends of friends, spend 12 hours together, it's fundamentally different than spending 3 hours together 4 times. Because every gathering has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And what is interesting is that in longer gatherings, once you've kind of gotten past the small talk, the middle, and there's this deeper middle, things start to change because you get tired. And when you get tired, your guard goes down. And if you want to be there, magic can start to happen.
We have just a minute left, and I think time to share a piece of advice that I really, really love, which is always pick an end time for your party. Know how to end it.
Yes. And know how to end it doesn't just mean choose your ending time. It means figure out how to allow people to, but first signal, give them a last call, as a bar does, you know, literally last call, or to signal, you know, join us in the living room for a closing drink. And then to close it not on logistics but on purpose and remind people what they came in. So if you did a 15 toast, to end the night by saying what it was that you loved there. And please share with me your stories with the Art of Gathering. You can share me. Gathering is about risk-taking and about courage. And I'd love to hear your courageous moves at hashtag The Art of Gathering and think about what you do that you could not do alone that would transform what it is that you want to do in the world.
Priya Parker, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Priya Parker, she is the author of The Art of Gathering, How We Meet and Why It Matters. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.